This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus. Police in Hong Kong have fired tear gas as rallies continue in downtown Hong Kong for a second night. Reporter Erin Hale is there.
Earlier, I was in a major sort of protest hotspot in Causeway Bay, which is an important shopping district, and there was no police presence. So actually, a few hours ago, several thousand people from that protest moved several kilometers to where police were firing on protesters at a second hotspot. So that, I think all of those protesters have basically started to converge in the same area and help each other out. The protesters have dug in. They have built barricades and they have created their own shield walls to defend themselves from riot police who continue to fire tear gas at them. But they seem prepared to stay until late into the night.
That's Erin Hale reporting for VOA from Hong Kong. President Donald Trump continued his attacks on the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore and one of its top officials, Congressman Elijah Cummings. In recent hearings, the African-American lawmaker assailed the Trump administration's treatment of migrants at the southern border with Mexico. In a string of Twitter comments, Trump called the 68-year-old Cummings, now in his 13th term in the House of Representatives, a brutal bully and claimed that his congressional district is a disgusting rat and rodent-infested mess. Trump rebuffed criticism of this latest attack on a minority lawmaker. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney rejected the notion that Trump's attacks on Cummings were racially motivated. On Fox News Sunday, he also belittled Democratic lawmakers who are continuing to advance the case for impeaching the president after special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony. This is VOA News. Afghan authorities say a car bomb and gun attack in Kabul has killed at least two people and injured 25 others. Officials and witnesses said several heavily armed suicide bombers stormed a compound housing the office of Afghanistan Green Trend, a political movement headed by the country's former spy chief, Amrullah Saleh. Saleh is also a vice presidential candidate of incumbent President Ashraf Ghani's electoral team for the country's upcoming election. 18 candidates began a two-month campaign Sunday amid fears of foul play, insecurity, and doubts whether the vote set for September 28th will actually take place. Election officials, however, have vowed to ensure a transparent and safe election, even though half of the Afghan territory is controlled or hotly contested by the Taliban insurgency. Russian police cracked down hard on a weekend demonstration in Moscow. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
Thousands of demonstrators gathered in the heart of the Russian capital to protest the exclusion of opposition candidates from the ballot for Moscow City Council, a vote scheduled to be held in September. Several activists wanting to run for a seat were arrested before the protest, while police took to the streets in riot gear. Demonstrators chanted slogans including "Russia will be free" and "Who are you beating?" as lines of helmeted police pushed into the crowds, beating people with batons and arresting hundreds. I'm Ben Thomas.
The United States, the European Union, and human rights groups denounced what they called the disproportionate and indiscriminate use of force against the demonstrators. Meanwhile, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, serving 30 days in jail for calling for the unauthorized protests, was hospitalized after suffering an acute allergic reaction on Sunday. World powers are meeting Iran to try to salvage the 2015 nuclear accord. VOA's Charles de Ledesma reports.
Representatives from Europe, China, and Russia, nations that are still committed to the nuclear deal, are meeting Iran's representative in Vienna to discuss how to salvage the 2015 pact. The diplomats aim to examine issues linked to the deal's implementation after Iran surpassed stockpile and enrichment limits set out in the deal. Experts warn that higher enrichment and a growing stockpile narrow the one-year window Iran would need to have enough material to make an atomic bomb, something Iran denies it wants, but the deal prevented. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Meanwhile, Iran has labeled a proposal to form a European coalition to escort tankers through the Persian Gulf hostile and provocative. Tensions have been mounting as Iran has become increasingly aggressive in the Strait of Hormuz, a key shipping lane that passes by Iranian territorial waters. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Cabinet minister has been arrested, that a cabinet minister has been denied bail, and that in terms of what has happened, she must be there in custody for the next 21 days while they make investigation.
The Zimbabwean anti-graft body charges the tourism minister with corruption.
How can you be a minister of works and housing and you don't have any technical background and you will be able to read the submission submitted to you from the ministry and be able to make sense out of it? And how will you determine that this amount of money is sufficient to build a road from point A to point B?
Nigerians criticize the ongoing Senate confirmation hearing of a list of cabinet nominees.
We are not painting a bad picture for our country, but we are trying to help our country. That is a shame. It's also a new trend that Tanzania today we notice, we register. After 1 week, someone has been kidnapped. Next week, someone is disappeared. It has never been our normal life in Tanzania. So.
And a Tanzanian rights group raises the alarm over kidnappings and disappearances of government critics. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Supporters of Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa say corruption charges against the current cabinet minister is a strong indication of his commitment to weed out graft. Their comment came after the newly established Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission charged Tourism Minister Prescar Mupfumura. She is the first minister to be charged with corruption in the current government. However, some critics say the charges are aimed at hoodwinking Zimbabweans into thinking the president is committed to fight against corruption. For analysis, I reach Maduku Lovemore, professor of law at the University of Zimbabwe.
Well, the charges are still not very clear, but what is coming out is that they believe she was acting contrary to her public duties, which is what corruption is all about, in issues that were directly or indirectly related to the amounts that you have mentioned, which is 95 million Zimbabwean dollars. But this is mainly in issues that dealt with her role, alleged role, in ordering NASA or the pension fund to transfer funds to some bank that later turned out not to be acting well, and then a few other cases of her own personal benefit. So the charges, as they stand at the moment, they create a reasonable impression that something happened, but that's up to the court to determine when the full trial takes place.
Some people are suggesting that this is a strong indication that President Emmerson Mnangagwa's determination or promise to fight corruption is in full gear. What is your take?
I think there is need to give some credit for the fact that this is an arrest of a minister who is in cabinet at this particular point. That's something that would indicate, at least on its own, some indication that the regime might want to be fighting corruption. Of course, we still have to wait and see who else is targeted. This case is different from the other cases where they were really wasting everyone's time by targeting former government officials in respect of very old transactions. I'm involved in a case in which one of the clients I'm representing is being charged of things that happened 20 years ago, things like that. So, but this one involves a sitting minister. So that is quite a credible step.
As you may know, Transparency International says Zimbabwe loses approximately $1 billion to corruption every year. So Zimbabweans themselves want the fight against corruption to be fought, and that public officials who embezzle public funds should be dealt with according to law. What is your take?
I mean, that is always the case, that we should use the law to deal with any suspected acts of corruption. At the same time, it's not so much crying about corruption without clearly proving it. So doing things in accordance with the law will help the country clearly show that it is committed to eradicating corruption. People must be very slow to just convict or find these persons accused of corruption guilty before they've gone through a full and open trial. And that has to happen first before we can then make a conclusion. But it is correct that Zimbabwe, like another nation, must fight corruption if we are to achieve our economic goals.
Skeptics are saying that this is just a choreographed prosecution of ZANU-PF elites meant to supposedly hoodwink Zimbabweans into believing that something is being done about corruption, and that the minister will soon be walking free despite the charges against her. What do you think of this skepticism?
Well, I think that is clearly a political opinion. There are those persons politically who never accept that ZANU-PF can do anything sensible. So that is the context. But from a purely objective point of view, you cannot dismiss what has now happened, that a cabinet minister has been arrested, that a cabinet minister has been denied bail, and that in terms of what has happened, she must be there in custody for the next 21 days while they make investigation. That in itself is not something you can take lightly. Because being in custody and being in jail is not something you can play around with. And that is a definite step that has been taken. So we obviously would have to wait to see what they do in the next few months. But for now, I think the better way of looking at things is to somewhat accept that this is a step that is appropriate.
Maduku Lovemore is a professor of law at the University of Zimbabwe. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. Nigerian opposition and civil society groups are criticizing the ongoing Senate hearing on a list of ministerial nominees for President Muhammadu Buhari's administration. The remark follows public concern that the government has not attached the portfolios of the candidate. Critics say this makes it difficult for the Senate to assess the qualifications and competence of the ministerial nominees. To learn more about the Senate hearing of the ministerial candidates, I read Chudi Chukwani, an economist and political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
I think the general perception of Nigerians is that the entire exercise going on there is just a complete charade. Because, number one, some of those ministers were already ministers before and they are coming back. And the president himself admitted that the performance of his administration in his first term was not good, you know, and he acknowledged that. We would have expected the senators to grill those ministers on why their performance was not up to par to lift the living standard of Nigerians. And then most of us were very disappointed that the Senate president would say that the answer that was given by the former Attorney General why that the government is not obeying the court order. You know, that answer is the most disgusting answer anybody could have given. And the Senate President said it's a good answer. How can you say that public interest overrides individual rights? That determination is made in the court of law. When the judge granted those people bail, the judge would have made that determination.
What do you make of this list? Because it's a significant increase from the initial 36 during his first term.
Nobody knows until the president sent a list of ministers without a portfolio. So nobody knows what they want to do, which ministries they want to do. They want to create a new ministry. The Senate didn't even bother to ask that question. You know, do you want to create new ministries? Are you dividing an already existing ministry, separating them? Nobody knows until the portfolios are assigned. It's only after the portfolios are assigned that those issues can come up. But those are the duty of the senators to inquire from the executive. Why is it increasing from 36 to 43? That is the duty of the senators. And in that regard, the senators have not been performing to the expectation of Nigerians. They are not providing Nigerians with the adequate oversight responsibilities that is given to them under the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. Because it is their oversight responsibility that would have forced them to ask the executive, why is your ministerial list increasing from 36 to 43? Demand an explanation.
Well, some are suggesting that these are mere political appointments and they are technocrats in those specific ministries. The minister is just supposed to carry out the vision of the president, so they don't necessarily have to be connoisseurs of that ministry in order to administer the vision of the president.
Oh, okay. So if that is the situation, why didn't the president appoint an Okada driver or a Keke driver to go and be the Minister of Works? How can you be a Minister of Works and Housing and you don't have any technical background and you will be able to read the submission submitted to you from the ministry and be able to make sense out of it? And how will you determine that this amount of money is sufficient to build a road from point A to point B if you don't have any technical knowledge?
So what is next about what Nigerians want to see at the Senate? Because it appears that all these designated ministers will be confirmed and they will become ministers.
Yes, of course. There is a affirmative Senate. You know, they are just a caricature thing they are doing there. Nigerians have already resigned their seat. The president has now been the second time. It is over. After 3 years, it's over. He will never come back again as president of Nigeria. So I believe Nigerians are now looking forward to the future. They've already given up on this one. This one is ended. It's finished. He will never be president again.
Chudi Chukwuani is an economist and political analyst in Nigeria. He spoke with me from Abuja. Meanwhile, tech-savvy Nigerian farmers are using a farming technique known as aeroponics, in which plants are grown in moisturized air. The practice is not locally well known, but those using it are on a mission to make it more popular. As Timothy Obieze reports from the town of Abeokuta, the technique could make a big difference in a country where violence and desertification have made huge amounts of land unfarmable.
Biochemist Samson Ogboli is popularly known as Nigeria's smart farmer. He and his team are growing crops without soil at a tech-based farm they started 3 years ago in Abeokuta in southwest Nigeria. They say they're on a mission to eliminate seasonal food scarcity in Nigeria.
Because we are the one controlling everything that the plant requires, we are not depending on season. So it's no longer seasonal farming. It is just farming any time of the year, meaning you can plant any time of the year, we can harvest any time of the year.
But setting up the smart farm was not easy. It required startup capital of more than $180,000, says Ogboli.
We were called wizards, demons, that we are doing something unnatural. So it took a whole lot to try to convince people that there is nothing demonic about what we are doing.
In Nigeria, only about 30 million hectares of farmland is being cultivated instead of 78.5 million hectares needed for food security. Widespread communal clashes, insurgency and desertification in the north are the top reasons arable land is lost. And only 49% of the cultivated land is fertile, a situation that bothers traditional farmers like Abubakar Ibrahim.
I don't have any other place that I will go and be farming again, apart from here. And here already the land has gotten weak. We just manage it for us not to stay like that.
In contrast, aeroponics does not require land like other traditional farm work. Nutrients for the plants are automatically regulated in a recycling system, greatly increasing productivity. Philip Ojo is Director General of Nigeria's National Agricultural Seeds Council. He says the government is encouraging new farming methods.
One very good thing that's actually very important, particularly when you're using it for yam or for cassava, you discover that you can rapidly multiply planting material that you can use outside there. So it's a way, it's one of those new technologies that we are even promoting.
Nigeria's agricultural sector contributes about 40% of the country's economic activities. The government wants to expand this percentage substantially. For the moment, most farmers lack the technical know-how to enhance productivity and do not have access to high-quality seeds to guarantee better harvests. Tech-savvy farmers like Ogboli are offering an alternative. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News in Abeokuta, Nigeria.
Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition says it's concerned about what it calls the illegal electronic
surveillance by the government. That monitoring, the group says, violates the privacy of Tanzanians and is therefore constitutional. The remarks come after the group also expressed concern about reports of an increase in kidnappings and disappearances of critics of the administration. To learn more about concerns of kidnappings and forced disappearances, I reach Onesmo Olengulumwa, the National Coordinator for the Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition.
We have issued a statement on the increasing rate of kidnap and forced disappearance, which is actually not a common issue here in Tanzania. Of course, we are not saying that these incidents have never been there. They have been never there, but actually the occurrence. And then the number of people who are going missing actually is increasing. And again, on the same time, the perpetrators are not held accountable, which is the major concern to us. Actually, we've actually followed our own reports and record of the kidnap and forced disappearance in the country. But recently, the Minister of Home Affairs issued a statement showing that the extent of the problem, that at least for the last 3 years, 100 people have been forcibly to disappear, and some of them, of course, came back. Problem involved for journalists, human rights defenders, businessmen, politicians, and all those who are most of the time found to be critiqued on the current regime.
Fatuma Karume, the former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, expressed concern about the increased rate of kidnappings, mainly targeting what she said are people who openly criticize the regime. Is this the situation on the ground? Because supporters of the CCM have dismissed this allegation as just pure allegation against the government, and that insecurity issues are being dealt with by the appropriate authority. Why do you deny that?
I'm not denying that there are some people who have been, of course, arrested as part of this move of kidnapping people. But actually, look at the way even President himself said it's purely a fake. It's just like a mockery. That how come that somebody, for example, the model, the business person, the way incident was taken, that these people took him, kidnapped him here and later on, dropped him almost somewhere there, and the car was later on found, and later on you arrest a taxi driver. You know, these are the kind of mockery we don't want to see when it comes to incident of forced disappearance and kidnapping in the country. And I agree with you that the targeted people are the critics.
Some are also expressing concern that it appears that they are being monitored electronically. And so the fear is that they could be kidnapped and all that. What is the human rights defenders in Tanzania doing about some of these concerns?
Of course, there is also a developing trend of illegal interference of individual communication, private communication, and surveillance, following up on what is happening on communication. And again, at the same time, the victims are human rights defenders, journalists, former leaders. You have heard of the recent ongoing saga of the previous leaders from the ruling party and the former ministers. Some of the information records are now out. You know, this is something that we led us today to sit down and actually call the government and the other state apparatus actually to ensure that we respect the communications of the people in the country. We are calling the government of Tanzania to enact a law, what we call it is the Data Protection and Privacy Act. As of now, more than 24 countries in Africa have enacted that law.
Your group this month called for a national conference to discuss the issue of kidnappings. However, some supporters of the CCM are saying that because you want to feel relevant, they dismissed your call as a publicity stunt just to create an impression to the international community, just to tarnish the reputation of the government. What is your response to that?
Some of the data that we are currently using, when it comes to kidnap and forced disappearance, are from the government. It's the minister who issued those statements, that at least 100 people. Among them, of course, we have human rights defenders, we have journalists, we have children. We are not painting a bad picture for our country, but we are trying to help our country. That is a shame. It is also a new trend that Tanzania today, we notice, we register. After 1 week, someone has been kidnapped. The next 2 weeks, someone has disappeared. It has never been our normal life in Tanzania. So what we are trying as human rights defenders is to help our country. Let's respect our laws. Let's respect the Constitution of the National Council of Tanzania. Let the security bodies be responsible and ensure that everyone, individual people and their property are properly secured in the country.
The Minister of Interior is saying that the police should find and arrest those spreading lies on social media platforms about alleged kidnappings and missing persons and all that. What do you say to that?
We are not spreading lies. We are telling the truth. If at all there are people who are spreading lies, of course, I will also support him.
let them be arrested. But for us, we are telling the facts. Some of the facts are coming from himself. So we are not telling lies. Maybe he's referring other people, but not us as human rights defenders. We're always very perfect and correct on whatever we say to public.
Onesmo Olengomrumwa is the national coordinator for the Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The UN World Food Programme says it plans to double food rations to assist 440,000 people affected by the Ebola virus and their contact over the next 6 months to respond to escalating needs in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The dramatic scale-up of food assistance is aimed at providing essential nutritional support to thousands of people affected by the Ebola virus. Recipients will receive food for 28 days. This is 1 week longer than the 21-day incubation period, the time interval from infection with the virus to onset of symptoms. The World Food Programme says the operation also will allow agencies working to contain the deadly virus to keep tabs on the health situation of contacts of victims and their families, as well as of confirmed and suspected cases. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoosel explains beneficiaries of this expanded program will be required to come to specific distribution sites every week to pick up their food rations.
That help us and that help WHO and the government to have those people coming to the health center where they receive the food, and when they receive the food, the health team can make the medical check needed in that 21 days period.
Verhoosel says people who have been infected by the Ebola virus and who have recovered will receive food rations for 1 year. The WFP spokesman says the operation is running into some problems of acceptance because of community mistrust. He says people affected by Ebola often are stigmatized by their neighbors, and some beneficiaries have been threatened because they are seen as posing risks to the community. To encourage community cooperation, he says WFP is planning to quadruple the number of primary schools in Ebola-affected areas that will receive nutritious hot lunches. He says chronic malnutrition is rife in this area, and for many children, this is the main or only meal of the day. He says the number of children slated to receive school meals will rise from 17,000 to 70,000. Verhoosel says WFP urgently needs $50 million over the next 6 months to carry out its operation in conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces, as well as in neighboring Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A judge in Australia's Northern Territory has been accused of racism towards Indigenous defendants. For the UAE, Phil Mercer has more from Sydney.
Court transcripts published in the Australian media show Judge Greg Borchers accusing an Aboriginal woman of abandoning her children while drunk in that great Indigenous fashion. He also said that anthropologists might one day discover why Indigenous parents desert their children on such a regular basis. In another transcript, Judge Borchers told an Indigenous defendant who had dragged his partner through the house by her hair that he was just like a primitive person. The comments are now the subject of an official complaint and have been condemned by the Australian Law Society. Its president is Arthur Moses.
These comments are racist because they are disparaging, discriminatory and offensive, insulting and humiliating to Indigenous Australians based solely on their race.
It's not the first time Judge Borcher's comments in court have landed him in trouble. 2 years ago, there was a complaint after he told a young teenager that he was taking advantage of his mother's murder. The judge told investigators that there was no excuse for some of his remarks, but he said a heavy workload, dealing with cases involving violence and child abuse with no days off or counselling, had taken its toll. Judge Borchers has yet to publicly comment on the latest allegations. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of Australia's population, but they account for more than a quarter of prison inmates. They also suffer higher rates of poverty and ill health and die, on average, 10 years before non-Aboriginal Australians. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, despite criticism from environmentalists, Tanzanian President John Magufuli has inaugurated a new hydroelectric power project in Selous Game Reserve, a World Heritage Site. The project is expected to provide an additional 2,100 megawatts of electricity, which will more than triple Tanzania's current installed hydropower capacity of 562 megawatts. For VOA, Charles Kombe has more from Morogoro.
Electricity is still a problem in Tanzania. According to the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, only 10% of households in Tanzania have access to the national grid. To meet the country's energy needs, the government is building a huge hydropower dam on Rufiji River in the heart of Selous Game Reserve, the protected area the size of Switzerland. Conservation organizations, including the World Wildlife Fund, have been raising concerns about the dam's environmental impact since the plans were released in 2009. President Magufuli says the project will not affect the environment and boost the economy through industrialization. The president says he understands that there have been some rumors that the project will destroy the environment, but that the project preserves the environment. He says the area that will be used is very small. He says for an area of more than 50,000 square kilometers, only 3% will be used. He says once completed, the dam will be owned by the Ministry of Tourism. Ahmed Elsued is the spokesman for Elsued Electric, an Egyptian company which has financial interest in the project. He says the company will open schools and help boost the economy.
We are honored to deal with Tanzania like Egypt. And since we arrived to Tanzania, we plan to make here as a hub for the industry and manufacturing in the region. We are planning to build factories not only for the Tanzania, but for the export. Our main purpose is how to make the Tanzanian government, Tanzanian people, have better living with our presence. Also, we are planning to make schools for technical, that over 90% of the people who will be working with us will be Tanzanians.
But the World Wildlife Fund says the project will endanger the livelihoods of some of 200,000 people, including farmers and fishermen living downstream from the proposed dam. Energy Minister Medadi Kalimani says construction is going smoothly. He says the project will be completed in a period of 42 months, and that up to now, 6 months have passed. He also says the work is going well. He says by 42 months, the project may be completed. According to the WWF, the Selous Game Reserve is one of Africa's largest remaining wildlife areas. It's home of elephants, black rhinos, and wild hunting dogs. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Morogoro, Tanzania.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the latest FIFA rankings published Thursday. Newly crowned African champions Algeria climbed up in the rankings. The Desert Foxes, who beat Senegal to lift the Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt the other week, moved up 28 places on July's list to go 40th in the world and 4th in Africa. Senegal retained top spot on the continent, moving up 2 places to reach 20th in the world, their best ever ranking. Nigeria, who won bronze in Egypt, went up 12 places to 33rd on the global list and 3rd in Africa. Tunisia, the other semi-finalist at the Nations Cup, was second in Africa, behind Senegal, but moved down four places to 29th in the world. Surprise quarter finalists Madagascar moved up four places to 96th overall. Benin, who knocked out Morocco in the last 16, went up six places to 82nd in the world, with Morocco also going up six places to 41st in the world and fifth in Africa. Nations Cup host Egypt went up nine spots to make the top 50, moving up to 49th overall. Ghana just below the Pharaohs in seventh in the African list, having maintained their position of 50th in the world. Belgium remained top of the global standings, followed by Brazil, France, and England. Still in football, former Sierra Leone FA official Abubakar Kaba has been banned by FIFA for 5 years and fined $50,000 for violating the organization's code of ethics. FIFA found him guilty of having accepted and received bribes in relation to the manipulation of international matches. Kaba, formerly an administrative secretary and acting general secretary in the Sierra Leone Football Association, was one of 15 players and officials originally suspended in 2014 during a match-fixing investigation. The FIFA inquiry had repeatedly been delayed but focused on several matches, one of which was a World Cup qualifier between Sierra Leone and South Africa in 2008. In April, former Sierra Leone captain Ibrahim Kagba, who played for the national team between 2000 and 2013, was banned for life by FIFA, who said he had been involved in attempted match manipulation of internationals. Like Kaba and Kabgo, several other African referees and officials have been punished for their links to convicted match fixer Perumal, a Singaporean national. And the 2020 African Nations Championship, CHAN, qualifying games kicked off this weekend. The tournament is restricted to African footballers who play in their own domestic league. Mali, Namibia, Uganda, and Ethiopia won their away matches, and Mauritania and Zambia forced away draws, while Burundi were the only home side to win in the regional qualifiers. Goals from Patrick Kadu, Mustafa Kiza, and Tadeo Luanga, and Uganda, a 3-1 win over Somalia, who staged their home match in neighboring Djibouti for security reasons. Kadu and Luanga were part of the Ugandan squad that reached the last 16 at the Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt this month, before losing narrowly to eventual runners-up Senegal. Ethiopia, the original 2020 hosts, who were replaced by Cameroon after falling behind with preparations for the biennial 16-team tournament, edged Djibouti 1-0 in Djibouti City. Botswana were held to a goalless draw by Zambia in Francistown in a repeat of the COSAFA Cup regional tournament final in South Africa last month. Burundi were the only side to maximize home advantage, overcoming South Sudan 2-0 in Bujumbura through second-half goals from Olivier Dusabe and Josephine Nshimiramana. Mali beat Guinea-Bissau 4-0. That victory virtually assures Mali of a place in the final qualifying round. Mauritania drew 0-0 away to debutants Cape Verde. The further eight first legs are scheduled for Sunday, including a clash of ARC East African rivals Tanzania and Kenya in Dar es Salaam. The Central African Republic received a walkover when Sao Tome and Principe said financial constraints prevented them from traveling to Bangui for the first leg. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you're hearing from Simi with Love in LXG, followed with Salon Titi, and then Becca featuring Shatta Wale, Welcome Your Way, Driving License.
I'll never forget this now. May you just come to my place, oh baby. I might have a let you out. Your sister driving me so, so crazy. Almost he gets me, you. Almost he gets me, oh, oh, hey. Baby, you're a 10 over 10. Now it's in on the tail of my friends. I brag about you.
you come back now, so. From the time you let me go, baby girl, I'm all alone. When I go see you back, when I go touch you back, tell me, baby, I will keep on trying until you come back, I'm alive. I will keep on trying, even if I fail, I will keep on trying, baby, 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 oh. Sorry, my life was nonsense. My personality, you claim my personality. You mean a similarity, now me a lady, no guinea guinea. Wow, you want us to love my caliber. You wanna make me your wife, come over. Now you down on your knees, begging me please to make a comeback to caliber. Yo, for all the love you do for me, show me pepper, now you call me. I don't care what they call me, I'm gonna take you back, cause this time sorry.
Me beautiful baby, I do beg my love, yo. Baby girl, I'm on my knees, so do you forgive me? You know me one and only, baby girl, I love you. Come back to me, baby, you're so alone to be. Yeah, me, you're so alone, baby. Come back to me, baby.
They don't buy motor car, they don't be lost for me, but I still express them. You love and they crepe and less them. Krakum, kaka, you. For me, what can I be more? What can I be slow? What can I be kaka, kaka?
Me beautiful baby, I do get no love, no. Baby girl, I'm on my knees, so do you forgive me? You know me one and only, baby girl, I love you. Come back to me, baby, you're so alone to be. Come back to me, baby, me, oh, sweet love you.
They say I don't come back again, no. Say I no pay dues, I'm like hello. Tell me what's your drive, I'm like ego. Your attitude is bad, I'm like yeah, but huh. Oh my, this is not the real me. I'm trying to fake it till I make it, do you feel me? In making hits, it's a crime, I am guilty. Cause I want riches that ain't nothing but building. Huh? Oh yeah, now make you go back. Make you want to step in the dope track. International gear from your local. Everything crispy, the vocal. Yeah. Oh yeah, now make you go back. Make you want to step in the dope track. International gear from your local. We are the door, we are door, we are.
I don't care to drive the license, but I enjoy my people insane. Play my plane to
Kim Kardashian. Fly your queen, watch me, make I do your correlation. Baby, yeah, baby, yeah. Make you not give me no allegation. Yeah, no say you bad, but me, I be worse. Show me some action, I know they need work. I say forget about media, you forget the press. So be, I say if you best, I go press the press. Baby, I say if I know you end up. If I'm not look sharp like a Kung Fu Adu, then thank you, oh, oh. Like by now, me now. Drive me like this. Baby, show your driving license. Driving license. Baby, show your driving license.
Long time I shouldn't have left you without a dope beat to step to. Married to the game, so I had to X you. And if you hear waiting for God, you get to ha. You go bow down, you go bow down. No be me, there, so for your countdown. No be me, just kill the show now. Now, same uptown girl from a safe room. Hey, oh yeah, now make you go back. Make you want to step on the dope track. International gear from a local, everything crisp to the vocal. Hey. Oh yeah, now make you go back. Make you want to step on the dope track. International gear, yeah, coming local. We are not dope, we are dope, yeah.
I don't care to drive the license, but I don't drive the people insane. With my plane to plane to nonsense.
Becca featuring Shatta Wale with Driving License, and that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There are serious concerns in South Africa that a serious and explosive power struggle is going on within the African National Congress, ANC, at the moment. The ANC, the party and movement of Nelson Mandela, fought for and defeated the apartheid regime in 1994. And for that, it was rewarded with the election of Nelson Mandela as the first black African president of South Africa and a large number of ANC candidates to parliament. But many political commentators have expressed concern that continued popularity of the ANC without challenge by an effective opposition would not be good for democracy in South Africa. And that has been a major concern as to how to find groups and parties that can rise up to challenge the ANC. Attempts have been made along the way, but these parties that have emerged could not really challenge dominance of the ANC. However, the recent presidential and parliamentary elections showed that the ANC has lost considerable support within South Africa and its representation is reduced. But also it showed that the two competing factions within the ANC, the faction of Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, and that of former President Jacob Zuma, emerged equally represented within the policy-making body of the ANC. In a sense, as there is now a consensus among political analysts in South Africa, the ANC is split down the middle between the Zuma faction and the Cyril Ramaphosa faction. And those that had hoped that President Cyril Ramaphosa would emerge completely victorious to dictate policy failed. Now he must compromise with the Zuma faction before enunciating any new policy. However, there have been some urgings in section of the South African media to the president that he must be brutal. By that they mean that they want him to root out the Zuma faction from the ANC. But this will only bring trouble for the ANC because the Zuma faction is well represented in the ANC as well as in the policy-making body. And in the last week and a half, we have seen some of the problems that is arising with this power struggle within the ANC. In a long-planned investigation, former President Zuma appeared to answer questions about allegations of corruption, particularly as it may relate to what has been called state capture and the Gupta family. It was very explosive. He stated that there had long been a conspiracy engineered in his view by a number of Western intelligence communities. He went on to accuse former members of his cabinet of being spies of the apartheid regime. And in one of the sessions, he came in and announced that he himself and his family are receiving death threats. So this really was very disturbing to many South Africans when they had these allegations. In the midst of this investigation, another explosive news came out. The head of the anti-corruption body announced that President Cyril Ramaphosa is guilty of corrupt practice relating to elections and that he had lied about certain contribution he had received and asked that this be investigated. The day after, in Parliament, the legal representative of the Economic Freedom Fighters announced that the party already had all information that the head of the anti-corruption body was noting. And he publicly accused President Cyril Ramaphosa of being linked to three business groups in Stellenbosch. Stellenbosch used to be the main seat of the main party members of the anti- and apartheid government. Regrettably, the South African media did not follow up on this latter investigation, hinting that the president has been captured by a business group in Stellenbosch, as they did with respect to state capture by the Gupta family. And while these things were being discussed, another bombshell came. The Constitutional Court, the highest court in South Africa, passed a judgment saying that the head of the anti-corruption body had acted in bad faith when she made a ruling against the head of the banking community and then said that she should pay some fines. This was followed by the media announcing that the head of the anti-corruption body had aligned herself with the Zuma faction of the ANC. So you have a situation where President Cyril Ramaphosa has taken up the mantle to fight corruption, and the head of the corruption agency was saying that the president himself was involved in corruption practices. So we do not know yet how this will play out within the ANC. But these are very dangerous times for the ANC. Regrettably, there are no one of major stature left in ANC like Nelson Mandela or Bishop Tutu is not active now that would intervene. But there should be urgent means to try to reconcile these two factions. Others will try to exploit this division, and this will not be to the interest and credit of the ANC. And this is also should be a warning to many Africans when outsiders are trying to interfere and trying to support one faction and other in an African country. They don't do it out of love. They do it because they have their own fundamental interest. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Shao Gag Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you must attend to your business with the vendor in the market and not to the noise of the market. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton.